Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Ask the Industry podcast, episode 64. For those of you new to the show, this is the podcast where I interview the most influential people from the world of stand-up, comedy, TV, and today, radio. Julia McKenzie is a executive producer at BBC Radio 4. She started her career at Kiss FM and then moved into BBC Radio and has produced shows with Danny Baker, Joe Brand, Mel and Sue, and many, many more, including The Jason Byrne Show, Ian de Montfort Is, Unbelievable, and French and Saunders for Radio 2. She knows her stuff. She knows what makes good radio for Radio 4. We talked about how the BBC picks and what it commissions, the gender and ethnic quotas on TV and if they exist in radio, the process from an idea landing in their lap to going out live on the air, and the steps that are in place internally to make that happen, and if the cliched Radio 4 audience stereotype is accurate, and more. If you want to follow along, you can find the show notes on my website, which is simoncane.co.uk/Ask the Industry Podcast, and please don't forget to join the Facebook group. It's called Ask the Industry Podcast, and it's on Facebook, obviously. That's the best place to find out when the next guests are going to be coming on, and you get to ask your questions to the influential people from the industry. Without any more delays, this is Julia McKenzie.
So my job title is Executive Editor, BBC Radio Comedy. That doesn't make much sense to most people. They don't really know what that is. So it really is, I'm head of radio comedy. I run the in-house radio comedy department at the BBC. So we make approximately 70% of Radio 4's comedy output. A bit of stuff for Radio 2. We've got a group of around about 12 producers and 6 production coordinators. So between us, we make a lot of content ranging from topical shows like News Quiz and Now Show, Dead Ringers, through to stuff with brand new acts like Tez Ilyas, for example.
And so you're in charge of commissioning that stuff or just producing that stuff? Or
producing it. So I oversee all of our development and what we offer to the commissioner, who's Sean-Ed William, who's the Radio 4's comedy commissioner. But we compete with indies for that business. So we have a sort of self-commissioning thing where I might say, let's commission a script to develop that project further, but we still have to go to the network effectively and give them what they want.
So it's kind of a board decision of like what goes through, or is it
in terms of our department?
Yeah.
Well, we'd have this thing called the PDG, which is the Programme Development Group, which is a monthly thing where producers, if they've got an idea, they submit it to that, and then I'll sit on that with 2 editors and a guest producer, and we collectively discuss it. I suppose I, you know, ultimately have the veto over it, and it's all about having that good relationship with the commissioner, knowing what she is after, anticipating what might tickle her, and then trying to encourage producers to try to go towards that.
In terms of what you're looking for a show, do you have like quotas for, you know, a certain, we need sort of a certain genre of comedy in this slot, a certain I know there was that thing with panel shows, for example, with gender, so I just wondered if there's like a certain amount of slots you have for slapstick comedy or sketch comedy, or how does it break down to what you have to sort of fit around in terms of the commissioning I don't know, bill, as it were?
Yeah, well, there's three main slots on Radio 4 where there's comedy. So 11.30 in the morning, 6.30 tea time and 11pm at night. And the 6.30 tea time is the one we've probably got the biggest audiences, 1.8 million roundabout. And that tends to be the more mainstream stuff that will cut through at that time of day, depending on what people are doing, whether in the car or at home or whatever. And that can be a variety of stuff, from panel shows through to audience sitcoms. And the morning and the evening have their own different textures, but it's not to say that the morning only has, you know, sitcoms, or 6.30 only has panel shows, or 11 o'clock at night only has experimental stuff. That can be across the board. You can find stand-up and sketch and topical shows and sort of illustrated lectures popping up across all of those things. And you mentioned about the women on panel shows. That was a particular issue in TV where, you know, David Cohen decided he had to sort of... David Cohen's a comedy writer. Danny Cohen decided that he had to sort of lay down the law a bit, because I guess the gentle nudging wasn't really resulting in a more diverse people on panels. But we haven't really had that issue so much in radio, because we've got a lot of female-fronted shows, and we also just believe it's a better show with women on it, really. So our panel shows generally will have half and half.
Mm. And in terms of the sort of a cliched joke that on the circuit of what the Radio 4 audience is, would you say that would be an accurate, or do you think that's sort of something that's just sort of changing or adapting, especially with the technology that you're kind of implementing with on-demand stuff and podcasts? And
yeah. Well, what do you think the cliché is about the Radio 4 audience?
The Radio 4 audience cliché that I keep seeing is sort of, I'd say, 30 to 45-ish kind of professional who sort of doesn't really watch as much TV. They listen to more radio than TV. And is more listening to it on the go than sort of wanting to sit down and actually consume like a passive TV show.
Mm.
That's the kind of cliché that I've... That people sort of play to on the circuit that I see.
Right.
Is there another one you see?
Well, I suppose it's a diverse audience. Millions of people listen to Radio 4, and it's a very eclectic network. Mm. You know, the average age is around about sort of 50 plus, but they also are appealing to the 30-somethings, and comedy in particular brings in a younger audience. So I think that although on-demand and sort of curating your own listening is obviously on the increase, it's still an extraordinarily high amount of people listen live, actually. And it's that shared experience of doing that and that sort of companionship throughout the day. You know, a lot of people who do listen on demand will catch up with stuff, you know, on the podcast. Like, we have something like the Friday Night Comedy Podcast, which is usually one or two in the podcast charts, and that's the one where we have our topical shows every week, and that's a bit of an appointment for people to subscribe to those. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people, when you said cliche, I thought you were going to say it's all about the Archers and the News, and it's very middle class and twee, which I've heard before. And, you know, some of the content is, you know, we'd call it middle class, which is perfectly fine, but people's preconceptions aren't often borne out by the content. And we have a lot of really quite unusual and challenging comedians who work with us, people who they're very surprised when they realise that they're on Radio 4, and we try to push boundaries. You know, it's adult content, it's an adult network, and so I think there's a lot of comedians who do stuff for Radio 4 that would be a surprise to a lot of people who don't listen to Radio 4.
Would it be, because I've spoken to David Quantick a little while ago, who's done radio and TV, and he said obviously it's slightly easier to do radio work, not as in like as in production or anything, but in terms of getting it through, because it's obviously less cost in terms of production equipment and all that kind of stuff. And in terms of pushing boundaries, do you think that's embedded into that, in the sense that a lot of it's in the mind of the listener? As a result, you can sort of play more with words because you're not having to graphically show something that might be edgy or whatever it would be.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's a lot of truth in that. You know, yes, the production teams are very small, so you have an intimate relationship as a producer with the artist or writer, and that's a great thing. In TV, if you're doing stuff in front of an audience, I mean, the crew is absolutely massive, and there's lots of people who have a vested interest in decision makings, which, you know, which can make it a bit frustrating. There's a certain purity in radio and that creative relationship. Yes, it's not as expensive. Radio 4 isn't awash with money, so every penny counts, but, you know, relatively speaking, it's not as expensive. So the stakes aren't as high as they are in TV, where they're having to get all sorts of additional investment. Yes, it's also true to say that you can go anywhere with your imagination. So, you know, the show Daphne Sounds Expensive, which was on recently, a sketch act trio, they're sort of going for modern-day goons, and the idea is that the show sounds really expensive because of the locations they're going to and the people who are involved, and they have a live band on stage. But, of course, they can be in the jungle one moment, they can be in a helicopter the next, and that is that versatility that you can do on radio and the listener goes with you, whereas on TV people go a bit pale and say, really, a helicopter? Mm. So, you know, or period stuff is another example that's very difficult to do on TV because it's so expensive with the sets, but on radio we've got a lot of flexibility. I just recently did a play with the Penny Dreadfuls, who are a comedy sketch group, and we've done about six of those, and the most recent one was set aboard the HMS Beagle, Darwin's first journey as a naturalist. And so, you know, you can create wonderful textures all with sound effects and scoring.
And also you've got your part of BBC Studios, or your link to that. How does that relationship work?
Yeah, so BBC Studios is basically like a sort of restructuring of the BBC to enable the in-house production to not just make content for BBC, but make it for other places as well. So TV-wise, that would be Channel 4, ITV, Sky, Netflix, whatever. And we, in radio, have always been part of TV comedy. So we will join them in BBC Studios with drama and entertainment. And hopefully it'll open a few doors for us in terms of, you know, thinking about podcasting, other commercial activities. We're obviously an important part of the TV setup because we nurture talent and grow talent and help talent find their voice. And so then we can suggest a career path into TV as well. So, you know, for all intents and purposes, not a great deal changes, but April next year is when we slightly separate out. So we're still owned by the BBC, but being part of this BBC Studios entity is almost like we're a sort of super indie, as it were, but owned by the BBC. So that we'll still expect to be the main supplier to the BBC, but we'll be able to, you know, get involved in slightly more commercial activity as well.
When you say move more into TV, mm-hmm. I know a lot of performers often, that's sort of their goal as such, because it gets so much exposure and it's so much sort of more prevalent in a way. Mm. Is it a case of you find a lot of radio comedians or writers want to move across, or is it also the other way? Some people want to move from TV back to radio, or not back, but, you know, across to radio.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think both of those are true. Some people, for them, the end goal is TV because, you know, somehow the kudos is greater. Although, you know, the audiences are often really quite small on TV these days compared to those on radio. I think that a lot of people don't realise that you are getting about 1.8 million on the radio, whereas some TV shows are lucky to scrape a few hundred thousand. But, you know, there is the more money and all the rest of it, it's sort of seen as more glamorous. And that's if they want to go in that direction, we do all we can to help them. It's good to not go too early. So, you know, radio is very helpful for establishing the worlds of the place you want to talk about, finding your voice, really honing those writing skills because you can't rely on any visual tricks. And so that when that's ready, it's hopefully a relatively painless transition. There are other people who come the other way. You're right. You know, they've done TV. They've enjoyed it. Find it a bit of a pain in the bum sometimes, you know, because it's exhausting. It takes out, you know, sometimes, you know, weeks and weeks of your life to do it. And there is this sort of, occasionally it's sort of production by committee. So they're quite happy to come back to radio and realise that it's quite liberating. So, you know, actors, for example, don't have to learn their lines, don't have to get covered in makeup and give up weeks of their life. Or writers just like the purity of it. So Alexei Sale, for instance, you know, quite an iconic figure. He has come back to do a series with us, a stand-up series, which he's recording at the moment. David Renwick, you know, celebrated writer of One Foot in the Grave and Jonathan Creek, he's written a series for David Jason for Radio 4. So, you know, there is quite a lot of that fluidity coming backwards and going forwards to radio and TV.
And in terms of opportunities for new writers and new performers, do you scout for it? Or I spoke to Anne Edivin, who does the writers' room, mm-hmm. and I know they've got like an open submission thing. And I know you have the new comedy competition and stuff. Are there lesser known ones? Because I know that one's very well known in the comedy community. Would you say that that's the main way that you find out about new people to come into radio?
Oh, well, there's lots of ways, really. Yeah, so there's a BBC Radio New Comedy Award, which we've just had the final of just a few days ago in Edinburgh. So that's obviously designed for performers. So that's open to anyone. They can submit 5 minutes of audio, which I think we had about 700 entries, got whittled down to 60. We then had these regional heats, which then ended up with two semi-finals and then six people in the final. So that's one way of doing it. The other way is, you know, anyone can send anything to any producers, you know, with email. So if you listen to Radio 4 and you like that comedy, just listen out at the end and you'll hear a producer's name. And either it'll say an indie production company or it'll say BBC Studios production. And you can get in touch with a producer and say, I liked your work, would you consider something for me? We also have an open door show, Newsjack, which is on 4 Extra, hosted by Nish Kumar. Anyone can write for that. That, for us, is an excellent source of new writers. So you don't need to be a writer-performer. It's mostly just writers. So that's writing topical jokes and sketches, and they have two series of that a year, and they have quite detailed briefing on the website. You can follow them. I think it's at BBC Newsjack, and they will give full details of how you can write to that, and if it gets on air, you get paid, so that's all very nice. And that's a great way for us of meeting new writers. It's been a really vital pipeline for us, Newsjack.
And, like, what's the, I don't want to say pick-up rate, but, like, obviously because there's only a certain number of slots, there's only a certain number of people you can take on. Like, how far ahead are you planning, for example? So in the next year, mm-hmm. do you already have, like, your schedule picked up? So if I was to email you an idea, for example, would it be me emailing you to say, I've got this idea for spring next year type thing, or is it quite, how long are the lead times and things like that? Especially if it's a news joke, obviously your joke could be out next week because it's so topical. But if you were sending an idea to a producer, which I think a lot of people wouldn't think to do necessarily, because I think we'd think that would annoy you a bit, especially if you got hundreds of emails.
Yes, well, I mean, it might annoy me. Yeah, there's every risk of that if I do get 100. I mean, but you know, it's just that's sort of our job, really, isn't it? The only thing is with email, I just find that I just drown in them sometimes. Right. And so someone might email me, and I'll look at it. And then I'll go and do something else or whatever. And then, you know, like covering of snow over footprints, it's gone further down into my inbox and I've forgotten about it because another 30 emails are coming all asking me to do things. So, you know, you have to be a bit persistent. So, yeah, in terms of lead time, we had a results of our spring round recently. And so they were for shows from next April onwards. So when we have our next commissioning round, which will be spring next year, that's going to be for shows that will go out from April 2018 onwards, which seems really far away. having said that, you know, if you were to email me this autumn and have this amazing idea, it does take a while to develop stuff, you know, and we would develop it and possibly commission a pilot if it got to that. And, you know, there's still a chance it could go on earlier than I've said. Stuff can drop out, or I can go to the commissioner and say, we have this amazing thing. I feel it has to go on now. What can we do? Mm. You know, stuff that has that sort of urgent feel of it must go on now, you know, you can do your best to try and make space for that.
Yeah,
so it's best not to second guess the commissioning process. That's our job, really. You know, just come up with good ideas.
No, I'm playing devil's advocate of a comedian or a writer who isn't sure how to break into it in that way, you know, mm-hmm. because I think a lot of us, I'm very much of a DIY mindset of I want to make something, so I'll do something like this. But I know a lot of performers who sort of have something that they want to get on, maybe for the kudos or maybe for the money or whatever it works out as, but they're not sure of how to take it to you guys. And as you said, every industry person I've spoken to is drowning in emails. Like and I can imagine us going through, I mean, I've done it where, like, you know, I've emailed a guest and they've said yes, and then a month later you've not heard anything and it's 2 days time and you sort of feel like I do want to check, but I don't want to annoy them because I know they're so busy. And I suppose what I'm asking for is, what, other than being nice and polite, what would you say are like the common mistakes people would make when they're trying to pitch you an idea or try and get your attention?
Well, I suppose the number one thing is listen to the output. So if it's always annoying when someone comes to you with something and they just clearly haven't really listened to what you do, yeah. You know, because that just seems to me a basic courtesy, and also just sort of really knowing your field. You know, you wouldn't try and design a pair of trousers for a trouser shop without checking out what trousers they've got already. Do you know what I mean? That will mean that you're more in tune with the sort of stuff we like and the people we're working with. So you don't offer us something identical that we're already doing. And you get some sense of what the tone will be. Sometimes people send stuff which they think is, in their view, a perfect Radio 4 thing. And it's just some sort of, I don't know, twee, awful thing that with people sort of running around shouting a lot, you know, set in a historical context, and just think, oh, well, that's very Radio 4. And it's just like, well, no, if that's your idea of what Radio 4 is, you haven't heard what we're doing, and that's not going to really, do the business for us. So it's listen to the output as much as you can, so you're well as informed as possible. And then I suppose it just helps if you get in touch and say, I was listening recently to so-and-so, I thought it was really interesting, and, you know, that's the sort of comedy I'd like to make. I've got an idea. Would you be able to, you know, would you be able to spare any time if I was to email you more information? You know, I wouldn't necessarily send a script at the first off. It's just establish that communication initially. And then if they agree, you send the paragraph through, and then you should probably chase it up after a week and say, I appreciate you're very busy, but have you had a chance to look at that paragraph? And you do just have to be persistent, I think. I mean, don't be sort of passive aggressive or whatever, because you don't know what's happening in that person's sort of life or work. But just sort of being professional and gently, you know, persistent is probably what's going to get you that answer in the end. And if someone ends up coming back and saying, listen, I'm sorry, I'm too overwhelmed, I don't have time to see it, to read it, hopefully they might suggest someone else who would, you know. But I suppose there's no point in just sitting there through politeness just thinking, oh, I better not bother them. You know, you want to try and get an answer, don't you, really? But, you know, you can't expect that everyone with unsolicited stuff will have lots of time to read it and then give you notes. I mean, the other slightly annoying thing is when people send you what feels like a bespoke email and ask you, would you read this thing? And then you do. But then you've discovered that 7 other colleagues in the department have also received this bespoke email, and just the name's been changed at the top. And what's a bit annoying about that is that if I decide to put aside an hour of my time to read something and then think about what I'm going to say to you and reply, because that's not an easy thing. You have to think carefully about how you respond. If I find that 7 other producers of mine have also put that time aside and we're all doing it with the best, you know, of intentions, it's just a waste of our time, really, because I think it's just fair for one person to do that. So, I mean, you could sort of put your hand up and say, I've emailed a few people, would you have any time? And then at least we know. But there's no good if all 7 of us are putting time aside to come back to you on your thing.
Yeah, of course. And it's sort of, I get the scattergun approach, but at the same token, it's not respect. Like, it would set you off on the wrong foot to work with that person as well.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you could forgive it, you can understand why it's done. It just doesn't feel completely transparent, really. But often in departments, there might be someone who tends to be the person who reads the unsolicited scripts. So, you know, it might be a case of calling up and finding out, is there someone who, you know, is more on the...
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Development side of things, and they can perhaps get you a quicker response.
And in terms of picking ideas and trying to take them forward to the commissioner, how hard is it for you to like set aside maybe your own personal tastes on radio comedy and go with what obviously the needs of the department or the channel are? Is that like quite a balancing thing for you, or are you sort of always thinking about the channel and sort of not necessarily your own, or is it always synced up quite nicely where your stuff has gone through because it's your taste is quite in keeping with the channel itself?
Yeah, I feel like my taste is very in keeping with Sean Ed, who's the commissioner. I mean, there are probably areas where, you know, she might like something and I thought, oh, I didn't like that, or and vice versa. But generally, we find that we are of the same opinion with certain stuff that we'll hear or whatever, and we'll both go, oh dear, or you know, whatever. So that's helpful. There are some things when I do prefer it if I can personally champion everything we put through. I want to be able to look the commissioner in the eye and say why I think it's really good and why she should commission it. But occasionally, yeah, my taste might not be to that, but a significant amount of people in the department disagree and think it's good. So I will sometimes just allow it to go through because I sort of think this isn't my cup of tea, but I might be proved wrong, but I can see there's craft in it and all the rest of it. And, you know, sometimes I am proved wrong and it is commissioned. Other times I'm proved right that my instinct was correct and it's not the right thing. But, you know, yes, I will. Times when it's not quite my thing, I will try and take other opinions and on balance put it through if I feel that, you know, it's got a chance.
On a devil's advocate point, what would you say to a comedian or writer who has a sort of stigma or cynicism in their head that says you need like an agent to be seen or heard by someone in the BBC?
Yeah, I don't really recognise that. Although, you know, you do establish a relationship with certain agents and they might get in touch and say, would you have a look at this script or would you meet my client? You know, that's fine. But I if I just got an email from someone who didn't have an agent with an idea or saying, come to this read-through, I wouldn't ignore them. I wouldn't think, oh, they haven't got an agent, I'm not interested. You know, sometimes it can be very exciting to discover someone who hasn't got any representation, you know, because it means that they're pretty new on the block. And so that's not off-putting to me at all.
And if you had a bit of advice for either a comedian or a writer who has an idea, but so treatment-wise or script-wise, you said don't send that in straight away. Like that sort of just get a conversation going before we even sort of see that going through. When you say you want to see something, are you specific in saying, like, so for example with Anne, she was like, just send me the first 10 pages because if you haven't made me laugh in that, there's no point in us doing this kind of thing. Is it that's what you'd ask for when you ask to see more about an idea, or would it be you just say send everything in and you'll just filter through what you want?
Yeah, I suppose the reason I say don't send the script initially is that, you know, I just can't guarantee that I'm going to read it, you know. So it's sort of, particularly if it's still at development stage, so I'd rather someone sent me a few lines giving me the gist of it so that I can at that point go, actually, we do have a sitcom about clowns who share a house, you know, so I think there's going to be too much of a sort of conflict there, so I think it's probably not for us. So I can head off any clashes because, you know, we're developing a hell of a lot of stuff and inevitably at some point there will be an overlap with something that a new person wants to submit. And never mind the stuff that indies are also getting on radio for. Sorry, I've forgotten the question.
Well, there's a follow-up thing, so I can move forward if you...
Oh, okay, yeah, so I've forgotten what you wanted me to say.
It was a general question.
Oh, yes, about, oh, yeah, you know, and then I'll say, if I might say, oh, I've got a big train journey coming up, so yeah, go on, send me that script then, you know, and then I'll have a look at that. But I don't need to say, oh, just send me the first 10 pages of it, that I'll just see the full script.
Yeah, yeah. And do you listen to podcasts outside of the remit of the BBC stuff?
Yes, I try to. I know a lot of our producers are big podcast listeners. I'm trying to think. I just have so much radio that I have to catch up with, to be honest with you. So, you know, I'm listening to stuff that producers have made that's going out. I'm listening to stuff that is, I'm having to sign off for compliance and catch up with TV comedy and all the rest of it. So I don't have huge amounts of time to listen to external podcasts as well. So if your next question is, have I got any favourites? I don't consistently listen to other podcasts, I must say. I know I should do more of that. I enjoyed Adam Buxton's podcast when I can grab that. I've heard Wooden Overcoats dip in and out, but often on the tube, for instance, you know, which is a good time to listen to stuff, I'm reading scripts, so, you know, it's just a question of having the physical time to take on board all this extra stuff.
Yeah, I think something that I learn every day more and more is everyone has only 24 hours in the day, and the amount of content that's going out is way more than 24 hours in a day.
Yeah.
And so you sort of have to really pick and choose you just have to value your own time, really.
Yeah.
And so I totally get that. My follow-up question was going to be, where do you see the future of radio going? Do you see it, like, because you've mentioned a couple of times that the live listeners are still very high, mm-hmm. versus the live watch, for example, on TV. And I mean, do you see it going more to like you taking ideas and putting them straight to on demand rather than live, because obviously there's only limited slots there? Or how do you see that developing?
Yeah, I think it has to keep developing in that slightly more on-demand space. I think what people have been loving is the Radio Player app, which is a BBC, the radio version of the BBC iPlayer. And what's been great about that is you can download most radio shows now. So that's really liberating, because before you had to have Wi-Fi to hear them. So, you know, that's obviously great. And I think we're going to see that really sort of starting to change behaviour as people just, you know, download a bunch of stuff and listen when it's more convenient to them. There are rules with us, with the BBC, and how many things that we can podcast, you know, because you might notice that not all of our shows are podcast, and that is a sort of BBC trust thing. It's about competition. You know, if we flooded the market with a load of podcasts, I suspect that the wider industry wouldn't be best pleased. So we have to be careful about that. We have been doing a daily podcast, The Edinburgh Fringe, and that's a new thing for us. And the restrictions around podcasting for us, BBC, is that it has to have been broadcast first or be used for broadcast. It can't just be a standalone podcast thing. And so our Funny for the Fringe is being used by the Comedy Club on 4Extra, so they use... repurpose our content for that podcast. We do have something that we are working on, which is a digital only comedy commission, which is sort of using social media to tell a story. So that's a new thing for us, which is sort of visualized type of audio comedy. So I think, you know, there will be more stuff to that. You know, we're trying to find, you know, clippable content and trying to attract people who aren't already on the Radio 4 website to find our content and come to us and listen to the full length stuff. So I do think it is inevitable that whilst live remains the significant way that people, you know, most significant way that people listen to Radio 4, it will only, you know, evolve as time goes on.
When someone sends in an idea, are you reading the idea? If you read the idea and you like it, but you know you can't commission it, would you look them up to see what they do, to see if they are a fit for other things? Or are you only looking for ideas?
Well, it would be interesting in seeing whether they could have any other use, you know, whether that's appearing in a sketch show or writing on another show. Definitely, yes. If I think this is a really funny idea, but I just can't see that it's ready for radio yet, sometimes people send the odd clip, you know, or YouTube link. I mean, don't send loads, because that's a bit, you know, if you just...
Don't send your hour.
Well, you know, you just sort of see, sometimes you see a very long email with multiple clips and links in, and just no one has the time to do that, really. So I think it's helpful if you edit yourself. So if you cherry pick what are my two best things that show me in the best light, rather than just say here's 27 things and I'll leave you to work out which of those you've got time for. I think we did need to see a little bit of self-selection going on.
And also that comes down to the research of who you're emailing, because
yeah,
if I know you're interested in one-liner comedy and I'm a one-liner comedian, I should send you jokes in that vein rather than trying to pitch to everyone who maybe doesn't care about, you know, they prefer sketch.
Yeah, I mean, if you're trying to get work on News Jack, you probably want to send some examples of topical comedy rather than send, you know, an hour and a half's long play, you know. So just sort of think sensibly, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And about the radio competition, I mean, the process of taking from 700 to 60, that sounds like a mammoth task. How, like, what's your criteria? I mean, I know on the website it's down to originality, material delivery, and all that kind of stuff. Are you able to, like, pinpoint a bit more? Is it just a gut feeling you get from the clip that people send in, or is it what's the kind of thing that goes through your mind when you're?
Well, I certainly have listened to some of those in the past. I didn't this year because I was judging on the semi-finals, so I didn't want to sort of come with any baggage. I think it is, you know, does it make you laugh is really the first thing, isn't it? You know, and I think I'm right in saying that there are three listens to every audio piece, or it might be two, you know, so it's not just one person's taste, which is quite important, just so everyone gets a fair chance. I think, you know, that does it make you laugh has to be the first starting point, really, and you can't always analyse that. Then if you've got a lot of people who are making you laugh, then you start applying other things like, is that original, or have I heard, you know, loads of other people do similar jokes in a similar territory, you know, because ultimately you want to end up with a spread of people who've got different sort of comedy styles. It's no good having, you know, six finalists who are all talking about not getting a girlfriend or whatever, you know. So yes, you know, originality, confidence of performance, you know, surprising, you know, rather than sort of predictable, very sort of predictable observational stuff, you know. Obviously these are people at the start of their careers, so you have to factor that in. It's not going to be the finished product, and it shouldn't be. So you accept a bit of rawness. It doesn't need to be perfectly recorded, but it should really make you laugh.
Yeah, it makes sense why you wouldn't want to listen and sort of keep the baggage aside from that. But yeah. Is it the same when you get them sent in? Because they can't obviously be anonymous because everyone has to send in their submission. But do you research beyond the clip, like when they're doing the three listens through, or is it literally just based on that one?
I suppose as it gets whittled down more, I think there's some stuff instinctively you just will reject, you know, or it might go in a maybe and then someone else will listen and it get rejected. As it starts to go a bit smaller, there's probably a bit more research done on it because there are certain criteria. I can't quote the exact criteria, but I think that we do have a restriction about how established a comic you are, how many years in the industry you've been, just so that it feels a genuine opportunity for newies. But, you know, we accept that a lot of people might have been going for years just working at the weekends and evenings because they got a day job. And so, you know, so we try and sort of make it as flexible as possible. But yes, we would start to do a bit more research and have a see. But with the comedy, we do just judge it on that audio. We're not going to think, that's not great, but I've just gone and found something they've done on YouTube, which is hilarious at 20 minutes. That's irrelevant. It has to be what they've submitted.
Okay, yeah, makes sense. And very quickly looking at the future of radio again, what is the, like, hardest challenge for you in terms of keeping up with, like, audience habits and technology changing for, like, sort of adjusting either content? I mean, do you find you have to adjust content, like, especially when you take it from live to, as in, like, a live play to the online medium, or is it, like you said, it has to have been on there and then it just gets put straight into?
Yeah, well, that's often the way it is, you know. It's gone out and then it's available to download immediately and there are no changes. I suppose, you know, if it's going to have a visual element, obviously you need to think differently. You know, if it's going to be in cut up into smaller chunks and you've got some visualization, you've got to think about how people will be consuming it. You know, so much audio now is consumed on a mobile phone or a tablet, so if you do have an accompanying visuals, you've got to think about, will they be easy to view on a phone? I don't think there's anything else particularly that one would change, because, you know, some people do anyway listen to radio with headphones on and have that very intimate experience of it. Whereas I know that obviously podcasts must be largely on headphones, you know. So there is perhaps, you know, there is a tendency for a more intimate storytelling type thing, like the American podcasts favour that very sort of intimate storytelling style, which perhaps we don't get quite so much on radio. You know, you have the likes of David Sedaris, who are storytelling people, but they have an audience there, and we have some kind of soundscape, you know, like the John Kearns, for instance, former Edinburgh Comedy Award winner. He did 15-minute things, which was sort of quite internal, very sort of layered, textured pieces. But yeah, I can't really think of any major change that we'd make.
No, I'm loving the fact that there's sort of this, I say, boom in long-form content, because I've sort of, for the last couple of years, noticed the, you know, tweets and microblogging just becoming a norm thing. But I'm finding that, especially with my audience, or especially with just general podcasters, friends of mine, the want for long-form content, and it doesn't mean filler content or anything, it just means that you sort of had something a bit more meaty to it is coming along, and I feel like a limitation on live radio might, I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but if you've got like a time slot to it, it sort of means that you kind of have an arc to work to, so it sort of has a beginning, middle and end, whereas if you didn't have a time limit, which obviously has its downsides as well, it sort of allows you to maybe do a little bit more in a different way.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, yes, we are occupying slots that are either 14 minutes long or 28 minutes long, so when you get it as a download, that's all you're going to get. Occasionally we do extended cuts of stuff, like for news quiz, for instance, it goes out at 28 minutes. We do an extended version which is 43, which is available as a podcast for four extra, and that's been very popular. I think it is interesting that a lot of younger people do listen to a lot of podcasts and longer form stuff, and they don't sort of realise effectively what they're listening to is a form of radio, and yet they would never go to Radio 4 for comedy. You know, they just sort of, it's not on their radar at all. I think they feel that what they're listening to is sort of groundbreaking stuff, this audio only narrative, which is, I think, a challenge for us, because we need to get to those people so they can hear our content. I think there is some great podcasting stuff. There is also stuff that is very unproduced and is very rambly. You know, it's just sometimes it's just things that just sort of drift all over the place. Maybe that's what people like, that sort of sound of a sense of eavesdropping on a thing, and that's what they like. But sometimes I think better production values would, you know, improve it. But, you know, it is liberating to have a flexible duration. That's certainly true for podcasts, you know, so you don't have to deliver at, you know, 27 minutes, 50 seconds, which is often what we do for Radio 4. To be able to sometimes do it at 40 minutes and sometimes do it at 17 is really nice. And that's what we found with this Funny from the Fringe podcast has been great. But sometimes concision does enhance the comedy, and giving that discipline of hitting certain points and then having some degree of resolution is a more satisfying listen.
Oh, definitely. And it gives the listener sort of some sort of consistency,
yeah.
Which, given that pretty much all of life comes down to routine and habit and a safety feeling of knowing what you're getting,
yeah,
that sort of has that advantage as well. But then there's sort of a niceness in, I don't want to say anarchy in having a longer or a shorter thing, but it sort of feels like, you know, you're sort of taking a mild risk and you're still getting your reward.
Yes, it's, you know, can have a more organic feel. Yes, absolutely. And you can clearly take lots of risks. You're not having to go through a commissioner. You're not, you don't have an executive editor type person giving you feedback. You know, if your audience like it, they'll talk about it and pass it on to each other. If they don't, they won't bother downloading, I suppose. So, you know, yeah, you can have a lot of fun and explore really creatively with podcasting. So, you know, I think it's a great thing that it exists, that's for sure.
Why do you think the comedy, or some of the comedy listening audience for, why do you think the comedy audience of podcast listeners don't consider Radio 4 then? Like, is it just that stigma we talked about before, where it's kind of archers?
Maybe. They sort of associate it perhaps with their parents, maybe, or it's just, maybe they don't listen to Radio 1 or any radio at all. Maybe there's no radio in the house and they don't realise you can get it on as an app. I'm not sure. This is just based on one or two conversations recently of someone who is a big comedy fan, likes a lot of live comedy, listens to podcasts, but just hadn't really considered the radio at all, which is, I could sort of see when it was less flexible and you couldn't download stuff, but I couldn't really, we didn't go into too much detail about why exactly she wasn't aware of it. I mean, that's the trouble sometimes with radio, is that you just get a few lines in a magazine, if you're lucky, where you can plug radio shows, you know, and you trail radio content, but often on that radio station itself, rather than advertising it more broadly. So I suppose that's where social media is useful, is people who are fans of Taz Ilias, for example, or Daphne or Nish Kumar, if they, or Lazy Susan, you know, if they say, oh, we've got a show on Radio 4, that will try and bring that audience over.
I asked them to everyone, quick fire for me, take as long as you want, but like you said, what's the best show you've ever seen?
Best show I've ever seen?
Or heard?
Blimey. I'm just going to say for this Edinburgh, because otherwise I'll just be here forever. I think Mr. Swallow Houdini by Nick Mohammed is the best show I've seen in Edinburgh so far.
What is the biggest problem in radio comedy, and how would you go about solving it?
not enough places to put our comedy is the thing. We've got too many great ideas and great talent and not enough space to put them. So we just need, I don't know, another radio station startup to take comedy or more platforms, really.
Okay. Would it not also link to the fact that people don't have more time in the day to listen to the content
Possibly,
that you put out?
Possibly, yes.
And what is the best bit of advice you've ever been given?
Oh, blimey.
Or do you want me to flip it and say what's the best bit of advice you could give someone?
Yes, yeah.
Which way around is better for you?
Yeah, I suppose if I was to give advice to anyone, I'd just say be persistent, be resilient, you know, do your research and don't give up. If you want to work in this industry, get as much experience as you can and take the initiative. And, you know, it's you who've got responsibility for shaping your own destiny. So don't sit around moaning that you don't get the opportunities. Go and create them.
Yeah, that's nice. Thank you very much for coming on.
Pleasure.
That was Julia. That was awesome. I've had a fair few number of TV people and writers on. I'm loving getting the radio perspective on the industry because it's something that is not seen as having as much kudos, as you said in the podcast, but they do get bigger audiences. For me, it's weird like that. Radio is such a personal medium and it's such a connection that you have with your audience that you can't really get with TV. TV to me feels like such a more passive experience and a viewership that isn't quite as engaged as it can be with radio. So I'm loving hearing what their take on it is and what the future of that platform is going to be. As always, it comes down to the usual thing, knowing the audience of the channel before you email in and being good and showing off your talent in a way that isn't too in your face and isn't too annoying for the person commissioning. Because even if your idea is great, if you annoy them, they're not going to want to work with you. It's all kind of the same thing. If you've been listening to all the episodes up to this point, you should be getting quite a good motif for that, except for every kind of station and every industry and every person runs in a different way. So I hope you got as much out of that as I did. If you like this, please do share it with someone who you think will get some value from it, and do consider giving me an honest review in iTunes. It really helps out. Also, don't forget to subscribe because we've got more radio producers coming on from different commercial stations later on in the year. If you want to get more podcasts about how the radio industry works and how you can get into it, please do subscribe and please do share this one because it really helps get on more guests in that area of the industry. Also, if you have some money spare, please do consider financially supporting the project. You can do that as a one-off donation via PayPal on my website, or you can become a patron from 80p an episode. Was what you just heard worth 80p? If it was, do consider sending me that, and all of it helps support the thing you value. So I can't thank you enough for even considering to do any of those things to help out this project. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for sharing. Thank you very much for donating if you do. And I will see you all in about 10 days' time. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.